From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents part three in its series of discussions about cultural and aesthetic modernism in literature, politics, and the arts. The speakers are Stephen Marcus of Columbia University, Harvey Gross of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, James Olney of North Carolina Central University, and Diane Leonard of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Each specializes in comparative literature, criticism, and literary history. Professors Marcus, Olney, and Gross are scholars at the National Humanities Center. How have the critics affected what you're talking about, modernism? What has been the role of the critics? Where does the critic enter into all of this, and how important is the critic?
Well, that's a very large and very interesting question. And I think one can say that, once again, there is a great continuity. The great modernist writers were, in one way or another themselves, important critics. Eliot is of course, the great example of that. Wordsworth is his predecessor, in the sense that they both write poetry and have programs, and the programs are critical programs. And the poetry is stylistically new, so the criticism, as it were, instructs people or points them in the right direction.
And creates the...
Creates the audience.
Creates the taste by which they are...
By which they are appreciated.
Who said that?
Wordsworth.
Okay.
It is Wordsworth. The poet must create
the
taste by which
he is
appreciated.
That's right. And certain Eliot did that.
And Eliot does something very similar. Now... What the modernist movements call forth, I think, in literature and the other arts, is in fact a new kind of conceptual criticism, because modernism is so complex and its structures are so rich, and because there is what we spoke about before, a sense of the autonomy of the work of art. A criticism arises, which is not simply, as it were, as the criticism of the 19th century tended to do, say this is a good or a bad piece of work and relate it to certain moral or social ideas at all. A criticism arises which is highly technical, which is analytic and elucidative. That is to say, modern works of art, because of their internal difficulty, need, as it were, formal means of analysis to make them comprehensible to the reader. And so there arose in different countries and in different kinds of criticism in Germany, in Russia, in England and America. Different kinds of new criticism arose, all of which were bound together by certain premises which had to do with the technical difficulty of the material that they were dealing with, and with an interest, as it were, in certain formal problems.
A neglect of what was always criticism's traditional function, evaluation.
Right.
There was an acceptance, say, when Cleanthes Brooks wrote The Well-Wrought Urn, that the poems that he chose for interpretation and explication were great poems. I mean, this is an assumption that it begins with, without ever having to justify that particular assumption, so that the poems by Donne and Wordsworth and Marvel that he analyzes are assumed to be part of a great canon that we all know, but without ever explicitly mentioning this fact.
Right. Now, I think that is quite true, that the new criticism, by and large, accepts the historical, accepts the canon, and accepts the revision that modernism made, let's say. That is to say, the modernist reading of literature itself was a reinterpretation of the past. Eliot makes that perfectly clear.
But certain of a remote past, you don't imitate the poetry of your father or grandfather, but you go back to Donne.
You go to the 17th century.
Yeah.
Or you go to the French symbolists in the 19th century who are geographically or linguistically remote.
Yes.
Too. But there, at the same time, however diverse one can say this was, and indeed there is great diversity, there is a sense in which this modern criticism that we're talking about has certain kinds of unity to it. There were certain assumptions about the integrity, the difficulty, the complexity, and the meaningfulness of great works of art. These works of art were making very complex statements, not to be reduced to rationality, finally, because they were inclusive of larger wholes than rationality. They were experiential wholes of one kind or another. Nevertheless, there were these quasi-autonomous structures that a criticism, as it were, a technical and very complex criticism, grew up in order to analyze and make apprehensible.
Now, and then certain normative assumptions began to be made, namely, a work would not be a good work if it were not complex. So that complexity becomes a kind of sine qua non of what makes a great modern work of art.
Yes, and if there's a great traditional simple work, this criticism would have nothing to say about it, or would have something very minimal to say about it, which was a paradox. Now, it would seem to me that what has happened in the last 15 years in criticism is quite a parallel to what happened with modernism. That is to say, the modernist movement comes to an end. It dies off gradually. The great figures are gone. And criticism doesn't come to an end at all, but begins, as it were, after it's exhausted the classic works, after it's done, one interpretation after another of the work, begins to, as it were, go off on its own, so to speak. And what we have now is a similar situation in both culture or literature and in criticism, that is to say, unlike the situation in the classic modernist period, there is no, as it were, single group of conceptual entities which can be loosely tied together as saying, this is what's going on. This is what's important. Here are the things we have to do. Instead, we have a kind of chaos rather than a plurality. That is, we characterize modernism originally as a plurality of movements, which fitted together in some loose way. We don't have that plurality any longer, it seems to me. That is, we don't have that kind of semi-orderliness.
And I think something alarming has taken place. Almost a complete lack of communication between this school of criticism and the poets and the writers who are, in a sense, creating now. Whereas in what we might call the traditional modernism, or to coin an oxymoron, classic modernism, the poets and the critics were often the same person. Whereas now, most of the poets I know wouldn't think of reading Derrida, for instance. It would be completely irrelevant to what they're doing. And similarly, I doubt whether the critics pay much attention to the poets who are operating. In some cases, I think Bloom has written on Ammons.
Ammon, the great modern figure.
Mm-hmm. And Ashbery, sure, perhaps. But these are almost exceptions to the rule.
Well, it would seem to me that what one has in the kind of criticism that we're talking about now, that is the current deconstructionist or post-structuralist criticism, is one more installment of what one had already had very fully and much more richly in modernism, but with, as it were, less texture to it. That is to say, as James pointed out clearly, the main figure is Nietzsche here. They are doing variations of one kind or another on Nietzsche. And what they're trying to demonstrate is, again, the bankruptcy of whatever rational, liberal, enlightened procedures intellectually were said even to exist vestigially in the modern period, because modern criticism, however much it depended upon the irrational qualities as well as the rational or quasi-rational structural achievements of modern, still had itself firmly anchored in the apprehensible, the comprehensible, the structured, and finally in some sort of rational discourse between the critic and a fairly identifiable audience. This is no longer seems to be the case.
Let me ask a question. This is a sincere question. I'm not trying to throw something in that will altogether upset the train that we're following. What does one make of several modern critics who seem not not at all to fall into this line that we've been tracing. Let me just mention four names. F.R. Leavis, Ivor Winters, Edmund Wilson, and Lionel Trilling. Now, none of them really fit into it, do they?
They're another generation, James.
Well, not another generation, however, from Eliot, later than Eliot, really.
No, but they're all, Eliot is the most profound influence on every one of them.
I think that's true.
Eliot is the chief influence on every one of them, except maybe Trilling, who shares Arnold and Eliot.
Yes.
But Eliot certainly makes F.R. Leavis. He certainly is tremendously informing for Edmund Wilson. Well, Sam Burt as well as Eliot.
Ivor Winters is a little bit
different. And Ivor Winters is a little bit different, although he reacts away from Eliot.
Extreme reactive. Right.
But is there a sort of a bifurcation of the influence of Eliot, which informs these four, in a certain sense, as against the line that goes that leads down into post-structuralist criticism?
Oh, yes. The four people you're talking about are much more, as it were, traditional men of letters, mm-hmm. In varying ways, you know, than the...
And three of them, Leavis, Wilson, and Trilling, were all interested in the literature and its relations to society. Winters was not. Winters was a complete formalist as a critic.
Right.
Really not interested in
the others were really cultural critics.
They're cultural critics and moralists.
Yes.
Although Winters was a moralist in a way.
Of a different kind.
A profound moralist,
right,
really.
Right. All these figures have, as it were, they're not merely modern figures. They have all four of them have profound connections with the 19th century.
Yes.
That is, they feel themselves as rooted in the 19th century as they feel themselves rooted in modernism as well. Now, I think what you see is that at the moment is that they have been, as it were, bracketed, so to speak, or bypassed only metaphorically,
yes,
by the figures we're talking about, because you don't bypass figures of that stature.
No. They will reassert themselves.
Yeah.
In fact, there's not a bifurcation of a tradition stemming from Eliot that leads to what is now called deconstruction at Yale and elsewhere. In fact, that's a continental tradition that
really has its
roots primarily in post-Husserlian phenomenology. And I think Heidegger is a more important figure even than Nietzsche for the deconstructionist.
Yeah, I think Heidegger and Nietzsche are really the two saints they cite constantly.
But in fact, we've had a bifurcation of continental versus Anglo-Saxon criticism, as we have in philosophy. And in both cases, I think the critical approaches are homologous with the philosophical schools which dominate phenomenology and those schools which attack it on the continent, and then that whole linguistic bias, the ordinary language philosophy of the analytic school in Britain. You have just two hugely different.
No, I think you're quite right. I was thinking of a point that Harvey Gross made a few minutes ago when he was saying that criticism in our time had largely come to be analytic. You have analytic tools to take it apart and to explain what's going on there and account for the difficulty, and the very difficulty makes it a great work. Without the difficulty, it wouldn't be a great work. I'm thinking, too, of a series of essays that F.R. Leavis wrote under the general heading. He always said he was going to turn them into a book. I don't think he did. Under the general heading, Judgment and Analysis, which he maintained were the two heads of criticism. On the one hand, analysis of what's there, and on the other hand, judgment of its worth or its value.
That's a paraphrase of Eliot. The function of criticism is the interpretation of text and the correction of taste. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
And what I understood you to be saying earlier was that the analytic strain had predominated
over the evaluative,
even in the Anglo-Saxon world, even in the Anglo-American world. And the four critics that I cited seemed to me not to quite to fit into that, because they're all exercising judgment as they're analyzing.
There's an interesting essay by a Czech structuralist named Mukhajovsky, in which he speaks of a kind of an alternation between two poles in the evolution of art forms. One is what he calls the structured aesthetic, and the other is what he calls the unstructured aesthetic. And he says that Romanticism was a kind of a great outburst of unstructuring, of a highly structured neoclassical aesthetic. And then realism is an attempt to restructure the aesthetic, and modernism is another form of unstructuring. And if we look at what's happened in literary criticism, I can see a similar development, it seems to me that in the movement we call structuralism, which began in linguistics and had some basis in phenomenology also, and was a strictly continental tradition, you have, especially in the later phase of structuralism in Paris in the 60s, you have such an almost overdose of structuration that it almost breeds this deconstruction, this opposite pole, this revolt against it, which then looks to Nietzsche and to Heidegger and to those that would like to subvert the analytical. So it seems to me that you see a reflection in criticism of a kind of thing that's happened in the arts.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to part three in the Center's series of discussions about cultural and aesthetic modernism in literature, politics, and the arts. The speakers are Harvey Gross of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, Diane Leonard of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Stephen Marcus of Columbia University, and James Olney of North Carolina Central University. Each is a specialist in comparative literature, literary history, and criticism. Professors Marcus, Olney, and Gross are scholars at the National Humanities Center. Here is Harvey Gross.
One of the difficulties, though, when we're talking about all of this is that the continental movements are so politicized and so tend to rely so much on trends and fashions that it's very often difficult to know what's going on that's really valuable. Do you find that's true, Diane? That one year we're all structuralists, the next year we're all, let's put it this way. One year we're all existentialists, next year we're all structuralists, now we're deconstructionists, and then what happens? I mean, what has this got to do with, in a sense, the interpretation of text and the correction of taste, or the recognition of artists, or the fate of art, if you like.
You're saying it's essentially become a matter of fashion.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm just putting it. It tends to seem that way, and this has something to do with the structure of the French university, and the professor in charge, and so on.
I find it very troubling, and I think it has something also to do with the structure of the Modern Language Association and our interminable conferences and people having to have papers and people performing rather than, I mean, often doing something for the sake of a performance rather than really being engaged in some sort of act of humility in trying to understand something. It seems to me that right now, there is a sort of decadence in our literary establishment in this country that perhaps does reflect continental trends. I don't want to sit in judgment on the continent. But.
Well, I do think there is a common strain here in these movements of criticism, in, as it were, the taking over of academic criticism by structuralism and then by the deconstruction thing, which does have, of course, you can trace an intellectual history to it, but I think there is a cultural side to it, which is expressed in its content and with the literature that it battens on, and that has to do with something we mentioned before, which is the disappearance of the individual or the disappearance of the subject. That is to say, what is at the center of so much of structuralism and a good deal of the deconstruction is, as it was, the decentering, as they say, you know, of literature, which is the decentering, as they say as well, of the subject, which means that...
And the elevation of language.
The elevation of a system, which is the system of language, and the elimination, as it were, of this funny conception that we inherited from the past called the individual, or the self, or an individual subjectivity. Now that seems to me, you know, although it's self-celebratory, it seems to me to be celebrating precisely the worst characteristics of the technological you know, culture that it's supposed to be opposing. I mean, because it's precisely the advanced, bureaucratic, computerized, technological, super-rationalized culture which is threatening individuality and selfhood in the world that these people are writing about.
What does all of this have to do, the role of the critic, the role of the writer, with politics as politics, partisan politics, the notion of power and authority? It certainly connects to the real world in that sense, doesn't it?
Well, first of all, I think the people that we're talking, I think they're essentially the kind of criticism we're, the politics of the kind of criticism we're talking about is either a quietism or a kind of anarchism, one or the other. That is to say, it doesn't see that, it doesn't see collective activity.
But there's a whole group, though, that call themselves Marxists.
There are a group who are extremely radical, but they're not the deconstructionists. It's Foucault, for example, and who is not a deconstructionist, but some sort of post-structuralist or structuralist, is extremely radical. And there are some people who, as it were, go with him. Although they're in, I would say, let's say the American deconstructionists are very conservative politically, in the sense that they have no political voice, so to speak, and no particular political position.
They don't extrapolate a politics from their criticism.
No, not easily. Unlike the modernists, all of whom extrapolate either conservative or radical politics from their aesthetics. Most of them conservative, but some of them, especially continental modernists, had a kind of radical a political position.
Radical either on the right or on the left.
Right. Right.
It seems to me a confused picture when one talks about the relationship in modernist literature between politics and literature, because one trend among modernist writers, I think, is to disavow all politics, to say they'll have nothing to do with it, they have no interest in it. They're interested in a pure art. One can trace the strain from Mallarmé and Valéry, La Poésie Pure, and so on, that has no the relationship to politics or anything else, for that matter, interested solely in the language and the music of the language, and then the other tendencies, which one sees, for example, in Yeats, unfortunately, or Pound, or Auden on the other side, to commit themselves to certain political stances or certain political positions, and it's very difficult for me to see what one can say about the relationship between politics and literature and the modernist movement that would be consistent and clear right across the board.
No, I don't think it's clear right across the board, except that one feels that the relation of most modernist writings to the society that they're written in and the society that they imagine and that they're projected out into is a very fierce, it tends to be a rather fierce and negative relation. That is to say, if you put the avowed political positions or non-political positions of the writers to one side, let's say so-and-so says, I have no interest in politics. Nevertheless, the power of his work is such that it drives the reader, as it were, into certain attitudes toward the culture he's living in, or the society he's... I mean, let's say Kafka has no politics. Nevertheless, if you read a book like The Trial or The Castle, you come away being affected or being moved in your attitudes toward the world you live in, no matter what Kafka said about his not having any politics. You feel something's wrong with the conception of justice in the world, something's wrong with the nature of authority in the world, something's radically amiss, you know, with the way things are. Now, that's a very indirect way, but nevertheless it's a radical way, and it's impossible, it seems to me, to think of Kafka without thinking of him having a radical vision of the human world.
You know, the classic statement, it seems to me, that when sort of going around here is in the poem of Auden's In Memory of W.B. Yeats, when he says poetry makes nothing happen. And by implication, it doesn't matter what the poet says or what the poet does. It doesn't matter what he writes. It doesn't matter which political side he takes. And that, of course, to the traditional poet, the poet of the 19th century would be anathema that idea, as it would have been anathema to Yeats, I think, to feel that his poetry made nothing happen. In fact, Yeats worried about whether his poetry, as he says in a late poem, whether it sent out some young Irishman to die. And he worries about his responsibility or his culpability. And it's a really troubling question, I think, and that's what for those poets who adopt one political stance or another, who deny all politics, disavow all politics, it's a very important question, whether their work makes something happen outside of this language system, whether it really makes things happen.
I think that most of the modernist writers were trying to transform consciousness. They weren't trying to have a direct effect in action, but they were trying to have a direct effect on consciousness.
And of course, well, that goes back to the romantic.
Yeah, but there I think one stops short. If you are transforming consciousness, then the next step is that you're transforming behavior.
Yes.
Ultimately, yes.
Oh, yes.
But the direct impact could only be on the consciousness.
No.
And then different forms of behavior might result from that.
Well, I think that you're letting them off too easily that way. It seems to me that they know that humanity wants and needs to be saved. And most of them have an idea of where salvation lies. And there's one figure we haven't mentioned yet, who is a very important modernist and who goes the whole way, and that's D.H. Lawrence. You know, he says, this is what the world needs, and I'm going to supply it. The world needs a sexual revolution. The world needs to have a revolution in the relation between men and women, and I'm going to dramatize what's wrong and how things should go right. You know, and he's a genius, and he proceeds to do it. And it seems to me that he has gone just a step further, let's say, than most of the modernists. But this is what, in one way or another, most of the great modern writers are up to. I think even Joyce in Ulysses is up. I don't see how you can read the last part of Ulysses without being aware that Joyce is, as it were, taking a bead on you as a reader, and saying, look, you ought to be moved in a certain way by this. And if you are moved in a certain way by this, not only will you read differently, you'll feel differently, you'll make different choices, you'll have a different life, finally.
Also, it's interesting that you mentioned Lawrence on the one hand and Joyce on the other. Lawrence was a completely traditional novelist, technically. That is, in terms of narrative and novelistic structure. He doesn't really go much further than Hardy went in structuring his novel. Yet, in as far as subject matter is concerned, he's certainly right there in the modern camp.
From the National Humanities Center, this has been part three in a series of discussions about cultural and aesthetic modernism. Harvey Gross teaches comparative literature at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Stephen Marcus served as chairman of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. Diane Leonard is a member of the Department of Comparative Literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. James Olney teaches English at North Carolina Central University. Professors Marcus, Olney, and Gross are scholars at the National Humanities Center. While at the center, Harvey Gross worked on a book about literary and cultural modernism entitled The First Moment of the Modern, the years between 1900 and 1914. James Olney's research project at the center focused on autobiography and cultural anthropology. And as a scholar at the National Humanities Center, Stephen Marcus wrote a book about the bourgeois novel. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for part three of the Center's series on cultural and aesthetic modernism. The panel will discuss the importance of social, artistic, and political criticism in the rise of modernism in the 20th century. Listen for answers and insights on cultural and aesthetic modernism, part three, this week from the National Humanities Center and Soundings.